Hello, welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group is hosting a panel discussion on the topic of bankruptcy courts and forum shopping and the Marshall case. My name is Judge Edith Jones, Chief Judge of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and I am your moderator. Please note, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of our distinguished speakers. Participating in today's discussion, in order of their seniority, are Professor David Skeel, the S. Samuel Arsht Professor of Corporate Law since 2004 at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. Professor Skeel has authored Icarus in the Boardroom and Debt's Dominion, A History of Bankruptcy Law in America, as well as numerous articles and other publications. He has received outstanding teaching awards and has also received an award for distinguished teaching called the University's Lindback Award. In addition to corporate law and bankruptcy, Professor Skeel writes on sovereign debt, law and religion, and poetry in the law. Our next panelist is Professor Todd J. Zawicki, George Mason University Foundation Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law and a senior scholar of the Mercatus Center at George Mason. He is also the co-editor of the Supreme Court Economic Review. From 2003 to 2004, Professor Zawicki was the director of the Office of Policy Planning at the Federal Trade Commission. He is the author of more than 70 articles in leading law reviews and peer-reviewed economics journals. He is one of the top 50 most downloaded law authors at the Social Science Review Network. He has testified numerous times before Congress on issues of consumer bankruptcy law and consumer credit. Professor Troy McKenzie is an assistant professor of law at New York University School of Law since 2007. His scholarly interests include bankruptcy, civil procedure, complex litigation, and the federal courts. He, in addition to clerking for the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, he clerked for Justice Stevens on the U.S. Supreme Court, and his article, Judicial Independence, Autonomy, and the Bankruptcy Courts, has just appeared in the Stanford Law Review. We will begin today's discussion with a brief introduction to Anna Nicole Smith and J. Pierce Marshall, and then our panelists will speak on the subject. I'm from Houston, Texas. Anna Nicole Smith became a familiar fixture on nighttime TV after her billionaire 90-year-old husband, J. Pierce Marshall, died after a mere 14 months of marriage in 1995. Anna Nicole was forced to file suit against the Marshall estate because, although her husband had been extraordinarily generous to her during their brief marriage, he had cut her out of his will. Thereupon ensued a 95-day jury trial in probate court in Harris County, Texas, involving dozens of witnesses. One of the more colorful exchanges occurred in a very colorful trial when Anna Nicole cussed out with the F word the lawyer for the Marshall estate. She was known for wearing tight-fitting and also colorfully displayed T-shirts to court every day. Little did we Houstonians know at the time that this battle fit for the National Enquirer was going on, that it would also evolve into one of the more complex and meaningful bankruptcy disputes in recent history. And so for that purpose, I will soon turn to Todd's Wiki. I'll make one more observation that was recently pointed out to me. Before he became a billionaire oil man, J. Pierce Marshall was a Yale University law professor. Maybe it's a sad commentary on the state of academia when in one's old age one has to turn to going to strip joints and marrying a stripper in one's dotage. But Pierce Marshall had specialized in wills and estates, and he was astute until the very end in regard to his wishes for his estate. So with that, I'll turn to Todd Zwicky, who will set up the details of the Marshall case and how it came into bankruptcy.
Thanks, Judge. And basically, the way this case arose is something that was somewhat novel here, but represents a threat of something, in my view, that could happen in any bankruptcy case and could affect virtually any probate, will, or contracts or anything else, which is why I think this is such an important case. What happened here was that, as you mentioned, they were married in 1994. In August 1995, Mr. Marshall died, thereby kicking off a spate of litigation that has now lasted about 10 times longer than their marriage, star-crossed marriage, actually worked. In December of 1995, a will contest was started in Texas. Meanwhile, then in January 1996, Anna Nicole Smith, also known as Vicki Lynn Marshall, her married name, filed a bankruptcy case in Southern California. The case was filed under somewhat unusual circumstances. Basically, when she filed bankruptcy, all she listed as her only claim was a supposed claim for sexual harassment by a female former housekeeper that had been filed. And in state court, Anna Nicole Smith let a default judgment be entered for $850,000. She then filed bankruptcy based on that claim. The claim got settled very quickly after bankruptcy was filed, leading to a question that many people have asked as to whether or not the initial lawsuit itself was collusively generated just in order for her to be able to manufacture bankruptcy jurisdiction. Meanwhile, then, through 1996, the case proceeded in California Bankruptcy Court. The son of Mr. Marshall, Pierce Marshall, filed a proof of claim in the bankruptcy case asking that a debt that he asserted against Anna Nicole Smith be declared non-dischargeable. Namely, he had claimed that her lawyers had defamed him as part of the Texas litigation. Then in March 1999, Anna Nicole's Chapter 11 case was confirmed. All the debts were discharged. The original sexual harassment case went away very quickly. And basically the case then was relatively done by March 1999. Nonetheless, in October 1999, the bankruptcy judge continued with the case. And the reason that arose was in response to the proof of claim filed by Pierce Marshall, Vicki filed a counterclaim claiming that Pierce had tortiously interfered with her gift, the father intended to leave money for her, but that Pierce had interfered with it. This then essentially led the bankruptcy judge to conduct a mini-trial on exactly the same issue that a probate case was going to occur in Texas. To cut to the chase, basically what ends up happening is in December 2000, the bankruptcy court entered a judgment. In 2001, the Texas probate court conducted a very long extended trial. The Texas probate court held that Vicki had received all the benefit that she was intended to receive and that she wasn't going to receive any further gift. That was contrary to the bankruptcy court judgment that it held that there was that she was entitled to half of his estate or $449 million. So the bankruptcy court, to recap, was December 2000. The Texas probate court was December 2001. Bankruptcy court opinion in California was appealed, and in March 2002, after the Texas probate court had acted, federal district court entered a judgment on a different ground and awarded Vicki $88 million. Now, why does this become an issue then? Well, the way it works out is that this prompts the question of when was the first judgment entered? Was it what counts? Was it the bankruptcy court decision in December 2000? the Texas probate decision in December 2001 or the federal district court opinion in March 2002. And what ends up happening in the case is it turns on the question of whether this is a core or non-core question. And why does that matter? Well, because under the code, if it is what is called a core matter, and I think David will certainly address this later, if it's a core matter, that means that the bankruptcy court is entitled to hear and determine matters that are considered core and enter a final judgment, which would mean that the bankruptcy court went first before the probate court, and the bankruptcy court ruling would trump the probate court. If, however, it was considered to be non-core, in that situation, what would happen is that the bankruptcy court opinion would be treated as a proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law to the district court, and then the district court would enter the final judgment. If her counterclaim against Pierce Marshall was non-core, that would mean that the Texas court action was entered first, and the California action was entered second. What ended up happening in the Ninth Circuit case was that the Ninth Circuit held that it was that her counterclaim was a non-core action. As a result, the Texas probate court opinion controlled. Now, there's two opinions in the case, and they hit on two different issues that I think are important. One is a constitutional issue. The other is a policy issue. The constitutional issue is basically the question implicated by the core-non-core distinction. What the court here held was that the test to be applied was a counterclaim is properly a core proceeding arising in a case under the bankruptcy code only if the counterclaim is so closely related to the proof of claim that the resolution of the counterclaim is necessary to resolve the allowance or disallowance of the claim itself. Here the court held that Vicki's tortious interference counterclaim was not necessary to resolve Pierce's defamation claim and thus was not integral to the claim's allowance process. As a result, it was not core, and as a result, what mattered was the district court opinion, not the bankruptcy court opinion. Now, you have noticed that creates an issue, because what it seems to suggest is the only problem here was that the district court just didn't act fast enough, and that what future cases would turn on would be how quickly one court would act relative to the other court. I think that ignores the bigger question that's implicated in cases like this, which is the policy question and what is basically a forum shopping question, which is basically the question of whether or not a litigant like Anna Nicole Smith, if she can read the writing on the wall in a state court, could essentially gin up jurisdiction in a bankruptcy court 1,500 miles away and essentially do what amounts to a relitigation of the state court case. And I think that presents a real problem of abuse of the bankruptcy process. And I think that what we see is a concurring opinion in the case by Judge Kleinfeld that I think hits much more at that question. And Judge Kleinfeld, and we could come back to this later, basically raises the question of why was the bankruptcy judge proceeding in this case at all when we had a perfectly timely thorough and ongoing process going on in the Texas court. And I would think that while the majority opinion in the case is good as far as it goes, I would have liked to see the Ninth Circuit go more down the line that Judge Kleinfeld suggests and lay out some brighter lines around bankruptcy court jurisdiction so as to prevent forum shopping in the future. As Judge Kleinfeld says, and I'll close on this quote, bankruptcy court is the right place to litigate whether a debt was dischargeable. Pierce could not very well obtain judgment in a Texas trial court controlling dischargeability of a debt in a California bankruptcy. Bankruptcy court is the wrong place to litigate a common law claim for personal injury to final judgment, and Pierce did not seek to litigate his personal injury claim there. And I would argue that sort of approach of thinking about what the relative comparative advantage of state court versus bankruptcy court is would be the way that I would like to see bankruptcy courts deal with these kind of questions going forward.
Thank you, Professor Zwicky. Let's move on to Professor McKenzie. What is your take on these subjects?
So this is Troy McKenzie, and there's a lot that I agree with with in Professor Zwicky's setup of the case. And just to take a step back, the problem here in some ways is a problem that makes bankruptcy such an interesting area, both as, you know, someone who studies bankruptcy procedure and also the federal courts, because of all the courts in the federal system, bankruptcy courts probably deal with bread and butter common law, state law matters the most frequently. I mean, many of the claims, counterclaims that arise in bankruptcy cases are really just plain vanilla contract, tort, et cetera, claims that are not bankruptcy specific, that could have been brought in some other forum, probably state court, maybe federal court on diversity jurisdiction or so forth, if in fact the debtor had never filed for bankruptcy in the first place. And that presents something of a puzzle. We have federal courts that are often dealing with matters that, by their nature, are not necessarily matters that could only arise in federal court. So how do we deal with that concern? Well, the Bankruptcy Code, as Professor Zwicky points out, sets up a distinction between core matters and non-core matters. Now, that distinction in part is also driven by a deeper concern about the role of bankruptcy judges as non-Article III judges, judges who don't have the protections of tenure doing good behavior and compensation that cannot be diminished during their terms of office. I think the majority opinion is a very, very thorough and careful approach to those sort of difficult background problems. Judge Beezer's opinion for the majority in the Ninth Circuit's decision, I think, sets out a very kind of nicely balanced way of trying to not necessarily get to the constitutional problem and also recognize that by nature, bankruptcy courts are always going to be dealing with matters that that may not necessarily be bankruptcy specific. In fact, the court rejected the argument, as was rejected below, that you know, the mere fact that this was a state law tort claim didn't necessarily oust the bankruptcy court of jurisdiction. But I have some I wouldn't say criticisms, but I would say there's some puzzles that the majority opinion and Judge Kleinfeld's concurring opinion set up that I leave me sort of scratching my head. The majority opinion reaches the conclusion that the counterclaim that was brought by Anna Nicole Smith was a compulsory counterclaim to the claim that was filed by Pierce. Yet even though it was a compulsory counterclaim, in other words, arose out of the same transaction or occurrence as the underlying claim, it was not a core matter. It was not a core proceeding. Now, that's a very, very puzzling distinction to draw. I mean, I think on the facts of the case and given the very odd circumstances, it was a very thin sort of road that the court had to go down. But it seems to me very, very difficult in future cases to be able to try to think about those circumstances in which a counterclaim is compulsory and yet is not a core proceeding for purposes of core versus non-core distinction in bankruptcy cases. And in some ways, that leaves me kind of unsatisfied in this case. I'd be much happier, frankly, if the court either went all the way and said every compulsory counterclaim necessarily is a core proceeding, or if the court went as far as I think Judge Kleinfeld would want to go, which is to look to the underlying nature of bankruptcy as really about setting and resetting the debtor-creditor relationship. Judge Kleinfeld's concurring opinion, I think, can be read as saying that in a case in which it's not clear that what's really going on in the underlying proceeding is resetting the debtor-creditor relationship, then there really shouldn't be bankruptcy jurisdiction in the first instance. So that's my first kind of critique of the way the majority and also the concurring opinion go about dealing with the case. Just a couple other brief comments before opening up the discussion more broadly. I'm not so worried about the prospect of forum shopping because we have a federal system. We have a very, frankly, uncoordinated court system in this country such that even federal courts have a fair amount of loose ligament holding them together. Forum shopping is something that simply comes along with having a federal system. There's nothing necessarily wrong with forum shopping. Even going back to Erie Railroad against Tompkins, we're really worried about forum shopping when it leads to some inequitable administration of the law, when it seems as though what's really going on is that a decision made in one place is substantively different from a decision made in another place, or when we think that the federal-state balance is being upset because of forum shopping. And I'm not so sure that this case presents that problem. I mean, it's clear that Anna Nicole Smith was filing for bankruptcy in California, but it should also be remembered that Pierce sort of went after her to file a proof of claim in the first instance. I think this would have been a much more alarming case if it was very, very obvious that filing for bankruptcy was simply an attempt to relitigate in another forum. And secondly, even if there was a clear intent to relitigate in a different forum, that's also something that comes along with our federal system and our commitment to the idea that a party should not be precluded unless it's clear that a prior judgment binds the party and should preclude that party from relitigating. It's one of the reasons why preclusion doctrine is so difficult to grasp for many of my students, because there's so many restrictions on when a party is precluded from relitigating. So those are just tensions that I think are inherent in our civil procedure system, our federal system of courts, and our commitments that are not necessarily bankruptcy commitments. So the case, I agree with Professor Zawicki, the case presents many interesting puzzles. I'm not entirely satisfied with the way that the majority or the concurring opinion treats the case, but I recognize that those puzzles are so difficult. Maybe this was the most elegant way of steering around them.
Thank you, Professor McKenzie. Now we'll hear from Professor Skeel for more of a historical review of what's at stake here.
As Judge Jones just suggested, what I'd like to do in this introductory segment of our discussion is just to step back for a minute or two and talk about the odd status of our bankruptcy courts and where this status came from historically. So I'll just give an overview of that. If you're interested in a much more detailed description, there's a little bit of it in Professor Zawicki's article and a lot of it in the wonderful analysis in Professor McKenzie's article. As their comments have suggested, the bankruptcy court has a very odd status. In form, the bankruptcy court is an adjunct of sorts of the district court. A bankruptcy court doesn't hear a bankruptcy case on its own initiative, at least technically. Technically, bankruptcy cases are referred to the bankruptcy court from the district court. And bankruptcy courts have a weird Article I status rather than the more normal Article III statuses that judges typically have, and that is contemplated most explicitly in the Constitution. Rather than being lifetime appointments, lifetime judges under Article III, bankruptcy judges are created under Article I of the Constitution, and in particular, I believe, from Congress's bankruptcy powers. As I just suggested, they don't have a lifetime appointment. They serve for 14-year terms, which can be renewed, but they are limited terms. And they can also be, they being bankruptcy judges, can be removed if there is cause for them to be removed. So bankruptcy judges are a bit of an odd duck. And the question this raises for folks who don't follow bankruptcy cases or bankruptcy courts is, where exactly did this strange beast come from? The first thing to know, I think, is that from 1898 until the 1970s, what we now call bankruptcy judges weren't called judges at all. They were called referees, and they were quite formally a part of the district court. And there were all kinds of strict limitations on what they could do and what they couldn't do that ranged from the very substantive to the very trivial. On the somewhat trivial side of the spectrum, although I think the bankruptcy, what we've now called judges, what were then called referees, didn't think it was so trivial. For much of this period, from 1898 to the 1970s, they weren't even allowed to wear judicial robes because nobody wanted to mistake them for true judges. By the 1970s, there was an increasing push from the bankruptcy referees themselves and from the bankruptcy bar to increase their status. And by the time Congress was debating the legislation that ultimately became the 1978 Code, which is our current bankruptcy law, there was a lot of discussion about simply making them Article III judges. And in fact, in the House version of the original legislation, or the original proposed legislation, bankruptcy judges were in fact Article III judges. But there was a big reaction against this, and the reaction was led by district court judges in particular, who quite candidly did not want bankruptcy judges to be Article III judges. They wanted bankruptcy judges to be different, and they fairly candidly suggested inferior to district court judges. The fear being that if bankruptcy judges were Article III judges, like district court judges that are Article III judges, the status of a district court judgeship would be significantly diluted. In the end, there was a big fight about this, in which Chief Justice, then Chief Justice Warren Burger, got involved and tried to persuade Jimmy Carter not to sign the legislation. But the long and the short of it was that there was something of a compromise. The bankruptcy judge was given bankruptcy judges and bankruptcy courts were given fairly broad jurisdiction to deal with bankruptcy and bankruptcy related issues, but they were not Article III judges. They were given 14-year terms and did not have a lifetime appointment. The problem with this arrangement, which was clear to a lot of people even at the time it was set up in 1978, was that it wasn't clear whether it was kosher under the Constitution, whether it was kosher to create a class of judges who were not Article III judges, did not have lifetime appointments, could be removed, but who looked an awful lot like Article III judges and had the kind of sweeping jurisdiction and sweeping powers that Article III judges have. A couple years later, a case, this got up to the Supreme Court. In fact, I think Professor McKenzie would probably remember the exact date. I think it was 1979. This issue got up to the Supreme Court in a case called Northern Pipeline, and in a very fractured set of decisions by the Supreme Court, struck down this jurisdictional apparatus. Now, Congress didn't fix the problem and didn't respond to Northern Pipeline right away, but in 1984, they took another try and they restructured the bankruptcy court framework. They did not make bankruptcy judges Article III judges, although the bankruptcy judges would have liked that. But what they did was they gave the district court more control over the bankruptcy case. They set up this system that I referred to at the outset, where technically the case is in the district court and the bankruptcy court only hears it because it has been referred to the bankruptcy court. And most importantly for our discussion, Congress created this distinction that Professor McKenzie and Professor Zwicky were talking about between core and non-core matters. Core matters are matters that are very closely related to the essentials of a bankruptcy case, and as has already been mentioned, a bankruptcy judge can make a final decision and issue a final order on a core matter. But with a non-core matter, technically what the bankruptcy judge does is makes proposed findings of facts. It makes a tentative decision. The actual decision needs to be made by the district court. All of this was designed to avoid the constitutional problem, to deal with the Northern Pipeline case, and yet not make bankruptcy judges Article III judges. And there are a number of ways, in addition to the ones I've mentioned, that that this is all set up to make clear that bankruptcy judges are not quite Article III judges. And so that's how we get a case like Marshall, and that's where we are now with all of this.
All right. Thank you very much. Now we'll begin the free-for-all round. I think we've set up a conflict of some sort between Professors Wicki and McKenzie, so let's hear first from Todd.
David Skeel just put his finger on one thing. One of the things that underlies this is the core-non-core distinction is taken from the Northern Pipeline case that he referenced. And what, in the way Justice Brennan uses the term in that opinion, is he refers to matters that are, quote, at the core of the federal bankruptcy power, which is a term that's used interchangeably with public rights. Public rights, which he describes as rights created by Congress in which Congress could establish procedures to adjudicate. Basically, rights that arise in bankruptcy and are created by bankruptcy. And he distinguishes that from private rights, which ends up kind of being used interchangeably with non-core to some extent, which is private rights are liability of one individual to another, as opposed to a right created by Congress. And so I think that intuitively many of the constitutional distinctions that are raised here overlap with these policy form shopping concerns that can arise. And I genuinely think this case presents kind of the nightmare form shopping scenario. And basically the way this conflict gets set up is potentially always a problem, which is that initially debt collection in the American system is done in state courts, and it's a race of diligence. Anybody who can get to the courthouse and collect against the debtor first gets to eat until he's full, and everybody else gets in line behind him. So that what we can think of is the standard debt collection process is an individualized race of diligence. And as David Skeel knows very well and describes very well in his book, Debt's Dominion, during the 19th century, for most of the 19th century, we didn't even have a federal bankruptcy law. We just had basically state debt collection under tort contract property and the like. Bankruptcy then comes in as part of a hybrid system. Bankruptcy changes the procedures but not the substance by which we apply the law. The logic of bankruptcy is that when there's not enough to go around, we no longer can trust creditors to eat until they're full, because at that point then they're taking food out of the mouths of other creditors and various other problems arise. So what bankruptcy does is moves us from the individualized debt collection world to a collective proceeding, and it's supposed to just change the procedures and not the substance. Underlying that, then, is always the threat of what I think was going on here, which is that a debtor could try to form shop from state court into federal court just to get a different substantive result. And I agree completely with Professor McKenzie that not all form shopping is bad. Form shopping, say, by a choice of law clause is a very good thing if it allows people to further private order. What I see as the form shopping here was a litigant who knew she was going to lose in state court, ginned up what looks to me to be a relatively artificial bankruptcy filing through this sexual harassment claim by her former female housekeeper that disappeared right after she filed bankruptcy, and then used that as leverage to retry the case here. Core, non-core, to some extent gets at that, and in this case got at it successfully, but I don't know that it closes the door if all it does is turn it into a race rather than a substantive decision, because I think Otherwise, I think this pattern could be replicated. The ease by which somebody can essentially manufacture bankruptcy jurisdiction, I think, is a real problem. Not just here, but potentially in corporate bankruptcy cases, class action cases, and a lot of other areas of law.
I think it's one can point out that one doesn't have to be insolvent in order to file bankruptcy,
right,
particularly in Chapter 11. And so I'd ask Professor McKenzie to comment on what Todd Zwicky has just said from looking at it from that standpoint, and also from the perception that bankruptcy courts have sort of a bias or predilection in favor of the debtor's interest, and how that affects the potential for forum shopping.
Well, Judge Jones, you're absolutely right. There is no insolvency requirement to get into Chapter 11. And of course, that was an intentional omission by Congress, in part to keep the bankruptcy forum open so that it would be receptive to businesses to come in to benefit from restructuring. I would say this about Todd's point. The only way to get to some clear line between core and non-core is either to go really even beyond what Judge Kleinfeld would do in his opinion, and simply say very, very, very strictly and directly what will be core, and limit core proceedings to a list, a defined list of matters. That's really the only way. And even then, I'm still somewhat skeptical that there'll be kind of an easy way of drawing the line between core and non-core. I think anyone who's practiced bankruptcy law knows how difficult it can be. The case law is really all over the place. And frankly, over time, you'll have courts in particular cases, bankruptcy courts in particular cases, itching to call something core because it's more efficient usually to have the bankruptcy court simply resolve the matter right there. It enhances the power of the bankruptcy court. And that line, drawing that line is so hazy and so difficult that unless there's some attempt to be incredibly clear about defining it by Congress, that line is always going to sort of squiggle about. The other way of getting around this problem, of course, is simply to make bankruptcy judges Article III judges, or alternatively, abolish the bankruptcy courts and throw their work back onto the docket of the Article III courts. And I have two very sort of quick thoughts about that. One is, I don't know whether the current Article III judges would be very happy about that for all the reasons that David Skeel pointed out. And the second is, I'm not sure whether it would actually in the long run improve bankruptcy adjudication. It might solve this problem. It might get rid of the problem of forum shopping to get into a bankruptcy court that will strain to call something core and so forth and get a different result. But at the end of the day, the current setup of bankruptcy courts has a very nice feature, and that is the appointment of bankruptcy judges is internal to the judiciary and tends to be a fairly straightforward merit selection process. And I think most people would agree that pound for pound, our bankruptcy adjudication system works pretty well. We have pretty good judges who know what they're doing and actually care about the bankruptcy system. If we moved away from that, if we either sort of gave bankruptcy work back to generalist Article III district courts, I'm not sure you could say the same thing. I mean, I'm not sure bankruptcy cases would get the kind of attention that they might well deserve. Or we might end up with deviation back to the mean, where the new Article III court simply appoints special masters or magistrates or so forth to take over these matters, in which case we're back to the same place that we are right now. And I just actually one further thought. This is a problem endemic to the entire Article III literature. The Supreme Court in Northern Pipeline, when it decided Northern Pipeline, it was actually in 1982 that the court decided Northern Pipeline, Justice Brennan's plurality opinion attempted to draw clean, clear lines between Article I power and Article III power. And that line slowly dissolved in the next several cases. And in fact, by the end of the 1980s, the Supreme Court, in a series of decisions leading up to Commodity Futures Trading Commission against Shore, essentially adopted a balancing test. And this is something that's happened before in the history of the Article III courts. The Supreme Court has found it very, very difficult to say some things are solely for the Article III courts and can't be encroached upon by congressional courts. It's one of those things that we get from history. There's always going to be some kind of line-drawing problem unless you give everybody Article III power at the end of the day.
Yeah. All right. Go ahead.
Here, if I could just add, I think Professor McKenzie points out the real difficult tension here, which is that in some sense we want to give bankruptcy judges a very broad jurisdiction because bankruptcy cases have a lot of moving parts and a lot of things need to be resolved and need to be resolved quickly, while at the same time we want to be protective of these constitutional other values. And what strikes me, to interject one quick thought, is what strikes me is that typically the way this is done is through sort of the self-restraint of bankruptcy judges. And what you see, there was an article that I'd like to say that I've written a lot of law review articles, but this is the first time I've ever cited People magazine in one of my footnotes.
Better late than never.
Yeah, right. A quote from the probate judge in here who said that if this had happened in Texas, a Texas bankruptcy judge would have said, finish your business, probate judge, and then come back here when you're done with the case. What to some extent was unusual about this case was that the bankruptcy judge did not exercise the kind of self-restraint I think you would typically see in a case like this, at least based on my observation, which is then what brought the appeals courts into this. In my view, that's one of the concerns I have with bankruptcy judges, Article I judges, is my impression is that by having a specialized docket, they have a tendency to gravitate to somewhat of a bankruptcy-centric view of the world that excludes some of the other structural elements of our court system, such as comity towards state courts and that sort of thing. And my sense is that that's one of the reasons why it makes sense to have them supervised by Article III judges with a more general jurisdiction or larger structural questions, attunement to structural questions, is to keep that balance intact.
Professor Skeel?
Well, I just have three quick thoughts that overlap and I think interact with things that both Professor McKenzie and Professor Zawicki have said. The first is that one thing that we haven't explicitly touched on yet in our discussion is simply, at least directly, is simply the fact that this is a case involving a celebrity. And one question I have is, how much should we read into a case that involves very high-profile, well-known celebrity, at least as we now define celebrity, type people? It may be that this kind of case is really largely sui generis because it is such a spectacular case on that dimension. And then the second is the question whether giving bankruptcy judges Article III status would or wouldn't solve this problem. I think that does lie at the heart of the discussion. And I guess I'm not so sure on this particular set of issues. I was struck in this case that the district court agreed with the bankruptcy court. So there didn't seem to have been lots of light between their two perspectives, at least in this particular case. And when I think about judges reaching out and grabbing high-profile cases, certainly bankruptcy judges do this sometimes, but it strikes me that some district judges do this as well. And I was thinking, as I was thinking of this case of Judge Rakoff in New York and the recent case involving the Bank of involving Bank of America and some of the problems with its acquisition of Merrill Lynch, and an SEC action. Judge Rakoff kind of reached out, unsettled a settlement, and took charge of what was another very different but also high-profile case. So it seems to me that a desire to grab this kind of case isn't unique to the bankruptcy court. And then the final point I wanted just to throw out is to I guess abstract a little further from the point that Professor Zawicki was making about bankruptcy courts and the importance of or the ideal of them deferring to other decision makers, particularly when the other decision makers are more specialized in a particular area. This concern is consistent with the concern a lot of us have had in bankruptcy for a long period of time, and just to repeat the concern, it's a concern that in cases where there's another decision maker, whether it's a probate court or whether it's an administrative agency or someone else who may have more expertise, ideally we probably want the bankruptcy judge to be deferring to them. And I certainly agree with that intuition and that starting point wholeheartedly, but the really tricky question, I think, and this is something that Professor McKinsey kind of was getting at as well, is what do we do? How do we get there? Do we try to set up some sort of mandatory system that forces bankruptcy judges to defer, or do we encourage them to defer? Do we criticize them when they don't defer, but make it non-mandatory? And it seems to me that trying to come up with a mandatory approach is fraught with dangers. If you had a rule that says bankruptcy judges have to defer to other judicial decision makers, we could have bankruptcy cases that went on for years and years and years. So I guess at the end of the day, I think this is a really important concern. I would be a little bit hesitant to try to craft a mandatory solution to it.
I have a few observations about this based on my former life as a bankruptcy lawyer and having been on the National Bankruptcy Review Commission a decade ago that studied the bankruptcy laws and having sat on appeals for some years. One of those is that in response to Professor Skeel, of course this is Edith Jones, how much can you read into this as a celebrity case? In actuality, the fact that this is a celebrity case makes it a good case to study, but the problem is fairly common, and I would point to Chapter 11 cases, which in the confirmation order always purport to grant post-confirmation jurisdiction to the bankruptcy court over everything that the lawyers can conceive of at the time. And that has led to bankruptcy courts attempting to reach out and involve themselves in disputes arising after confirmation of Chapter 11 plans that they really don't have any authority to be meddling in. So I would say this is just sort of paradigmatic of something that's a fairly common situation in the everyday proceeding. Now, why does this matter? It matters to me bankruptcy courts are, whether we like it or not, the premier commercial court in the United States. That means that they look at commercial issues more routinely than any other courts do, and because of that, they have a great influence on the development and rights in commercial law cases. Other countries in the world have commercial courts that specialize in that area. We have the bankruptcy courts, and I certainly agree that the bankruptcy judges as a group are well selected. They tend to be very talented individuals, but I also think there is a tendency for that court to look at commercial law through the perspective of bankruptcy, which is the wrong way to do it. And so therefore, the more authority that the bankruptcy courts exercise that really is beyond what they should exercise has great ramifications for our commercial law system. The final thing I would say in regard to whether bankruptcy, and this isn't criticism, but this is just observation, whether and how much we should have bankruptcy judges being forced to defer to other administrative bodies, clearly there would be questions of the expeditiousness of the bankruptcy proceeding if it were forced to await various sorts of rulings, let's say in a complex tax dispute or even in some probate disputes, for instance. But bankruptcy administration did interfere very, very severely with family law before the passage of the BAP-CPA in 2005 because it was not at all unusual for deadbeat dads to go into bankruptcy court and effectively relitigate their responsibilities for alimony and child support. And the bankruptcy law in 2005 was changed to eliminate virtually all those disputes from bankruptcy court jurisdiction, and therefore I think eliminate a severe source of tension with the state system and unfairness to families caught in the dual litigation systems. So while Anna Nicole Smith's case presents an extreme and colorful example and very thought-provoking issues, I think it's quite representative of the kind of problems that seem to occur regularly.
Judge Jones, Professor McKenzie talks a lot about, in his article, a very interesting discussion of the appointment process of bankruptcy judges, and obviously as a circuit judge, you're intimately involved in that process. To a lot of us, it's a little bit of a black box, and I'd be interested in any observations you might have on that, and in particular, the extent to which most bankruptcy judges seek reappointment, the process by which they're appointed or reappointed, in any sort of do you perceive lobbying efforts by lawyers one way or another? How frequently are reappointments contested and that sort of thing?
On paper, the system is purely a merit appointment system for 14 years. In actuality, in my experience, it is pretty close to a pure merit-based appointment system. I have rarely, if ever, witnessed lobbying for the appointment of certain people to a bankruptcy judgeship position. And if there's anything consistent about the appointment effort, it is that when there's a profusion of bankruptcies out in society, you have fewer people vying for bankruptcy judge slots. And when times are good, there are more people vying for them. But we have, at least in the Fifth Circuit, been fortunate to have a lot of very fine people willing to step down from active private practice to come into the bankruptcy courts and be good judges. What people don't realize, on the other hand, is that in every way possible, the bankruptcy judges as a group have moved to extend and enhance their positions so that they are de facto resembling Article III judges. In other words, the statute was modified for reappointment after a 14-year term to be more of a system where there's presumed right to reappointment unless good cause is shown not to reappoint a bankruptcy judge. There have been recent efforts to say that bankruptcy judges who have retired after their term is up to be available for automatic recall to office, which could be a very meaningful thing if it were to occur, because they would enjoy sort of a dual status. They could be nominally retired as bankruptcy judges, go out into private practice, become mediators or lawyers, and then occasionally step back into the role as bankruptcy judges. So the people practicing opposite them would really sense that they were wearing two hats. Potentially, it would create a very strange situation, and yet they're making efforts to extend that possibility.
Having been confirmed yourself as an Article III judge and appointed Article I judges, do you have any general reflections on the difference between the two in terms of the way it's often teed up in terms of independence and that sort of thing?
I sort of agree with the observation that was made in one of these articles. I guess it was Professor McKenzie's article that bankruptcy judges enjoy a great degree of independence. And I think that the extrinsic political pressures can be brought to bear on judges in any capacity, no matter how they are appointed. So I think they're about as well insulated from those pressures as Article III judges are. And in fact, in a certain way, they're better off than Article III because they can serve a 14-year term, leave the bench, go into private practice, and at age 65, and make a lot of money. And at age 65, their pension comes into play, which is a very generous pension. Whereas those of us who are appointed to the federal bench have golden handcuffs, and we have to serve until we're 65. There's no option to step down and then collect a pension. So
you lose your pension if you step down before you're 65?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
But the bankruptcy and magistrate judges don't. So if you're talking about functionally assuring independence, the bankruptcy judges have a pretty good shot at that. On the other hand, I do believe that the way in which the system works poses the problem of capture and parochialism, because they are such a highly specialized court, and they tend to have all their friendships within the court, all their experience. That makes them qualified for judges also means that they do not have necessarily broad experience across other areas of federal jurisdiction or law.
This is Troy McKenzie. I wanted to make one very quick interjection. I'm very happy that Professor Zwicky and Cole have written this piece. And in response to Professor Skeel, I'm also incredibly happy that it involves Anna Nicole Smith, because I teach this case in my civil procedure class, the Supreme Court version of the case, and when I teach bankruptcy litigation, a seminar I teach, I also talk about the case in the Ninth Circuit, and this is the only way I can keep my students awake. So I'm delighted that it involved a celebrity and there was lots of money involved, so that, as Judge Jones said, these issues percolate but don't often go up on appeal because usually there may not be enough money around or there may not be enough of a care, frankly, among the litigants to pursue it. But in a case like this where there was lots of money and lots of acrimony, it went up, and in the case I can now teach because my students will know exactly who I'm talking about when I set out the dramatis personae.
Well, this is Todd. One thing that raises, Troy, is the observation that this case has already been to the Supreme Court once, and I think one of the things that's interesting about that case was that in many ways it was specifically remanded along the lines we've been talking about, which is that the Supreme Court basically said, in that case, was a relatively narrow decision that there was no thing called the probate exception to federal court or bankruptcy court jurisdiction. And in many ways, the Supreme Court kind of threw us back into the briar patch and says, there is nothing called the probate exception, so you have to decide this on a case-by-case basis, right?
Right.
And basically said, do it in a more discretionary fashion. So, which kind of redoubled the point here, I guess. Maybe the final question for us to think about is: do we think this would go up to the Supreme Court again? I mean, my perception is no, that this is no longer really a cert-worthy case. At this point, that the first case was taken purely as a to resolve that one clear issue of law, And then what we have here is something that looks more like a typical circuit court case without a glaring circuit split or anything like that. But I'd be interested in others' sense as to whether or not the Supreme Court might take another bite at this.
So this is Troy McKenzie again. You know, the court took a case about bankruptcy jurisdiction, I guess last term, Travelers against Travelers Insurance against Bailey. And that was a case involving the extent of the bankruptcy courts related to jurisdiction. That was the question presented. And the court really kind of avoided the main question presented in the case in its ultimate decision. So I get the sense that there might be some interest at the court about broader questions of the extent of bankruptcy jurisdiction. But I do suspect that at the end of the day, this case might not necessarily go up again because, you know, unless a clear split could be shown, you know, that it might be difficult for this to be the vehicle that presents the question again. And as you said earlier, the court really did invite the kind of decision that the Ninth Circuit eventually ruled on. And in fact, you read Justice Ginsburg's opinion for the Supreme Court when the case went up, and it really sort of read, even though there is no probate exception, we don't really think Anna Nicole Smith should win at the end of the day. I mean, it was it didn't quite go that far, but when you see footnotes that list all of the potential problems, you know, preclusion, so on and so forth, that's usually not a good sign if you're the litigant who, you know, nominally wins in the Supreme Court.
This is David Skeel. I'd just like to make one last comment going in a very different direction and to bring it back to the forum shopping issue. And that is just to make the point that it's important not to assume forum shopping is always bad and to treat forum shopping as a dirty word. To the extent what we've seen in this case and in this discussion is an example of bankruptcy courts reaching out and grabbing things that they probably shouldn't reach out and grab, that's problematic, and we want to talk about why that seems to be happening, and we've had a little bit of discussion about that. But in other contexts, forum shopping can, and at least in my view, be a good thing. And the context when you use the word forum shopping in bankruptcy that most people think about is the decision of most corporate, big corporate debtors to go to either Delaware or to New York to file their cases. And I personally am of the view that that forum shopping, at least to the extent it involves Delaware, has been beneficial to the bankruptcy system, not pernicious. So when we talk about forum shopping, there's a tendency to assume that it's always bad. But I take Professors Zwicky and Cole not to be saying that, but to be saying here is a species of forum shopping that's problematic and we need to be worried about it.
Exactly, yes. This is Todd. I agree with that characterization.
As Judge Jones, I'll just add one editorial. Maybe this is for a subsequent podcast, but it's not clear to me that the migration of Chapter 11s to New York and Delaware has always been beneficial.
I thought this is David Skeel, and I was waiting for you to jump in on that. I will not fight you on your earlier criticism that bankruptcy courts should not be reaching out and grabbing at post confirmation matters, but I will fight you on this one. I absolutely believe that, and Delaware in particular has had a beneficial effect, not a pernicious one, but maybe we can talk about that another time.
We'll have to talk about that in the next podcast on Chapter 22s, the subsequent filing of cases confirmed in Delaware. But I had to lower myself to the bait, I'll say that. But I guess at this point I would say to the audience that we thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you so much.